cha ka cha ti ka de se tu dhammam anukampimam pajam.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So this that's a beautiful tradition that we have maintained. So those are purported to be words uttered just after the enlightenment of the Buddha, the awakening of the Buddha. And remember, what did he awaken to? He awakened to a sense of completion, human completion, the end of his personal anxieties about everything. And so awakening may be described as the end of suffering. And it's such a profound and important thing that somebody has discovered a method of being present in the world without the all those extra grievous experiences that humans have. They have them sometimes very, very deeply and explicitly, but at the same time there's always an implicit level of tension in existence, waiting for something surprising or unpleasant to happen. We know that such things do happen, so humans are always somewhat on the alert for that. So somebody who has come to that, and that's that is substantially the most important aspect of the Buddha. So they have the deities of the Indian pantheon of the time. They have the most important deity asking that the Buddha share this with others. It's very interesting, and apparently the thought process was that, this is subtle. It took me a lot of figuring to get to here, and I know the message is a little hard to catch, so I don't know whether I really want to spend my time talking if people don't get it. So this kind of thought had arisen in the Buddha's mind, is, am I just going to waste my time? So the deity had a sense of his hesitation. I mean, he could have spent the rest of his life just sitting under the same Bodhi tree. And, in those days, of course, and afterwards, mendicants did that, and they would just go through the nearest village, and people offered them enough food to get by. But in India, you didn't, just some robes, and you don't need much. And so he could have spent the rest of his life just enjoying his existential liberation, his freedom. But he decided that he would teach. It's a very important story because we have to realize, I'm coming here trying to talk about inner states, what it is like to be, for me, how I understand it is to be a human, what I've gone through and so forth. I'm trying to translate that into learning experiences to share. And it's tricky. It's very hard to articulate, and you never know quite whether you're referring to common experiences. Does the other person understand what I'm talking about and so forth? Are we on the same page? So it's a daunting task. Imagine it's like my grade 11 math teacher facing me, thinking, is it worth it? So anyway, I have some karma to pay off anyway, so if somebody doesn't understand, I understand, because I certainly wasn't tuned in on certain occasions when wise and generous people were offering some good advice. But this is what it's about, and that invitation is okay. You know, it's very nice that that's the first time I've actually heard it read in English. We must do this every time. I mean, it's very beautiful. I know what it means, but I mean, it's nice to have it articulated that this is an invitation right to the Buddha. In fact, out of compassion to share the experiences. And to make sure that you understand, this is just a very, this is not very mysterious or strange or esoteric. This is, and this is not about gods or anything like that. It's about your ordinary experience of everyday life. Now, I was up in this, there's one room set aside for the monk. It's kind of just a nice little room with some paintings on the wall and a nice table up there. And so, I had said to Izzy, I'll be down at 1 minute after nine and everything. And I'm sitting there and I forgot all about everything. I'm just kind of enjoying myself and reflecting and stuff. Right, I'm in a minute. Go down there. One thing that was coming up was, and I don't know why I've never really thought of this, but it's such a beautiful phrase. There was a movie a while back, which I did not see, called The Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, is it? And it's a phrase, it's not a movie title. It's borrowed from a medieval Christian saint who talked about how to develop, that when you are in harmony with truth, and that has to do with virtue, there is an ever-recurring experience of this light. It's eternal, an eternal sunshine. But you can't get into the sunshiny spot except through the spotless mind. It's when the mind, and this is very identical to the descriptions of the Buddha, talking about the hindrances. The hindrances are described as mist and dust and clouds, which cloud the moon or the sun. But when the mists and dust and cloud clear up, the sun, the moon appears radiant, luminous, always. And their realization is that, you know, behind that dust is just some sort of impediment between you and that luminosity. So it's always there. And it's just these psychic irritants that prevent that appreciation of that luminous experience. And the Pali word is pabhasara. The mind is luminous, but is obscured by the hindrances. And when not obscured by the hindrances, the mind becomes luminous again. It becomes radiant. So it is available universally in all humans. When the mind is not harassed, it returns to its essential state, which is quite joyful. And now we can see this in even in very young children or babies, you know, when they're not, because they don't have much in the way of intellectual processes going on. They don't have to, there's no sophisticated thinking about getting towards happiness, to this, the emotional state of well-being. It's really the impediments of the mind. It's the processes of the mind that become impediments to that. And it's not an intellectual path to ease and luminosity. It's more like deconstructing our how we impede it, what gets in the way of it. It's just removing these things that we assume we have, you know, we're thinking through these irritants. We're getting up in the morning and carefully clothing ourselves in our harassments. I need to put on my hair shirt. Where's my hair shirt, dear? I haven't felt itchy for 8 hours. So this is the important thing to understand, is that this is a built in, more or less, the default mode is the eternal sunshine, and we just need to cease from harassment. Sometimes I call this civil disobedience, and that's you have to come to a point, I think, in your life when you say, I refuse to participate in this, you know, because normal social demands and the demands of the world are perhaps, especially in our culture, which is a very large culture, it's all through, it's European culture, North American, Western culture, and has pervaded much of the world. It's a critical culture. There's lots of negativities, there's lots of judgments, there's the endless ambition language in it. There's anxiety language in it. There's acquisitive language in it, and there's intimidating language in it. And a lot of it is guaranteed to produce anxiety and self-doubt. And so, more or less, this spiritual advocation is that you no longer will participate in that. You see, non-participant in this. So this is peaceful civil disobedience. You know, you've chosen not to obey these commands and things which are anti-human, really. We become our own enemies. So this is something we see this. I'm not going along with this. This is not. There are other wise people and wise company outside of this, which I choose to identify with. That's my group, and it's very important that you are supported by people of like mind. If you don't have them, you have to go on your own, but you just decide sometimes that you're not going with the general direction, that however others will be angry, will be hateful, I shall not. Others will be greedy and acquisitive, I shall not. Others will be agitated, I shall not. Others will be heavy, sorrowful, anxious, I shall not. I shall not participate in that. Others will. I mean, you just have to stop waiting for others to stop it. You just say, it's absolute fact right till my last breath that people will be like this. They will be like this. I'm not waiting till they drop out. I'm dropping out now. So dropping out of that, and this is one of the beautiful suttas. It's one of the last suttas in the numbered sayings. There's 44 of these kind of asseverations, which is, you know, others will be angry, I will not. Others will be hateful, I will not. I will not do this anymore. And this is a simple statement. This is what, when we do meditation and breath meditation and so forth, this is also the case. We're just making a declaration. Say, I'm not interested in those voices anymore. They don't have power over me because I've ceased. I'm not interested in being that way. And when you do this and you make that choice of prevention and dismissal, then you're already very close to that experience of just peace. You will see how it floods up, and the moment it floods up, nature will tell you, you have done the right thing, my dear. You are on the right track, my dear. I shall kiss you on the forehead, my dear. And so this is your whole system. We respond to this absence of the enemy, and the enemy is ignorance. It's just misdirection. And we get this from the beginning, very early in life. We get misdirections, and then we take up these misdirections, follow them, and get lost with them. So this is, we say, look, I better sit down, calm down. And you might find out you've just been walking in circles around something. It's not very far away. Peace is not very far away. It's very close. You're not that far away from it. Although you've been walking in the wrong direction and around in circles for a long time, you actually haven't gone very far from the center. Have you ever walked these labyrinth mazes? We have one at the monastery. We borrowed it from Chartres Cathedral. It's a mysterious thing. No, who knows where these things came from, but you kind of walk in circles. It's very artfully done, and you enter it, and you appear to be making very rapid progress towards the center. But they're tricky. And then they somehow you end up out. You know, you're out three-quarters of the way done this thing, and you're at the farthest point from the center. You were closer at the beginning. We thought you were making great progress, but you end up way, you know, as far away, removed from the center. And it's a very interesting experience, because it's a lot like life. Like you were maybe thinking in certain parts of your life that you know, when you remember back, perhaps even as a teenager or something, you might have been closer in some ways to being unburdened by the future and the past. And then life gets complicated and things happen, and you end up a long ways away. But then it rapidly ends up in the center. Now you're in the center, and that's great, but you have to go back. So then you have to leave the labyrinth, and so you go back out. But once you've been through the labyrinth also, you know that the illusion of being a long ways from the center is just that. It's an illusion. And this, you know, if you get something on a retreat like this or in some of your meditation, you finally find your center, feel found, you know. And then, of course, the meditation ends, and what comes up, the first little nervous voice is, I hope I don't lose this. And of course, that's how you lose it. First thing is to doubt it, and you do lose it. But you have to know how to get back to it. And you know that when you sit down and face your mind, the little voices will whisper, oh, that was probably one shot thing. Maybe you'll never get back there. And so a lot of experiences of doubt. And these, you have to remember the words, is that it's always there. It's eternal. It's just the impediments that we throw up between ourselves and it. So we're just manufacturing it. So this is what we mean by faith or trust, confidence. It's confidence in yourself, confidence in the reality of this is a universal experience, that if we cease from running around aimlessly getting lost, then we will rapidly appear in the center in full illumination. We will have arrived home. And the more often you go back and forth from this, the more you know each time. You say, well, you know, I'm a little lost now, but I'll be back. It's just a matter of finding some space. So this is the process, is to more, not that you will never be lost or never lose it, but that you become more and more comfortable about finding your way back, and you know the way back. So this is the, you know, this is the choices we make. And so this is probably my last formal teaching tour. You'll be able to hear me lots on audios and, you know, iTunes and what's the other one? YouTube. Yeah. I talk a lot, so you'll be hearing lots from me. But my main message, and it has been for about at least 15 years, is that I think a lot of the teachings have a little bit gone off the track, that the center of the teachings is choice. that you are to make radical choices about the content in your mind, not to spend a lot of time analyzing or even watching these things, but to recognize them and as friend or foe. And if they are foe, you are to free yourself from them right away. And if they're a friend, you are not to just watch them. You are to welcome them in and be the best host in the world and make sure that they want to come back. You feed them, you increase them, you nourish them, you garden, you grow them, and that to deepen them. These are the instructions in the sixth factor of the path. This is the instruction. And the seventh and eighth factor are mindfulness and concentration. And it's the preliminary instructions to how we're going to get to this sunshine of the spotless mind. The eighth factor is the spotless mind. The mind has now ceased from its endless harassments. And it will, for you, as for any other person who ceases from personal self-irritants, psychic irritants and harassments, it will be lovely. Identically lovely. I mean, everybody has it in their own form of loveliness. This is the Japanese idea of wabi-sabi, this perfectly imperfect cups and so forth that have a little natural, nothing's, you don't have trying to for absolute perfection. The perfection is in the fact that everything's a little, each thing is unique. So your perfection is in your uniqueness, but the components will be the similar. The components will be the simple absence of these irritants of anger and craving and agitation and heaviness, sloth, depression, and doubt, the paralytic doubt, excessive skeptical inability to decide. These are what have subsided, and in all cases those are absent. And in all cases, when those are absent, some form of joy is present. Emotional joy. The mind just rejoices in it, in the absence of this pain. It never wants it to end. That's why they could be eternal. It could go on forever, and you would never get tired of it. Your own quality of joy. Some people think, oh well, you got to have different moods, don't you? You have to. In order to appreciate joy, you have to have sorrow, don't you? Wrong. They're mutually exclusive. You never, ever get tired of joy. If you get tired of joy, if you say, I'd be bored with joy. No, you're either joyful or you're bored. You're not bored with joy. You're either happy or you're not. You're not bored with being happy. You can't, that doesn't work that way. You've got to go back to logic 101 here. Can't have, they're mutually exclusive. It doesn't wear out and you're going to get tired of it. So this is the spiritual understanding of these emotional qualities, and they just to the degree that you can, it's not a matter of absorbing them. They're already available. It's the other things that you have are impeding your setting between you and them. That's what needs to be removed. So just things need to be removed. The other things will appear because the space, the other things will rush in. Space, lightness, joy, freedom from a sense of oppression and anxiety, all these things. So this is why I like to talk about, you know, this is just make it quick. Just remove it. Remove it from the experience. Don't analyze it. Don't sit with it. Don't watch it. Remove it. And try to prevent it from arising Stop the trouble before it starts. That's the easiest solution. But if the trouble starts, then deal with it quick, get it out, and go back. There's no value in pondering and analyzing and following it. It's to be gotten rid of. The Buddha gives endless metaphors for this. He says, you know, that once the mind is kind of very attentive to this, it's like a frying pan that's been heated for hours, and then somebody drops a little drop of water on it, and now, and it's gone, evaporation. So that fast, the mind of the, once you warm the mind up to this positive state, then any hindrance that comes in is instantly evaporated by the wholesome natures, the purifying nature of the wholesome mind. That fast. So you can keep that image in mind that from time to time, if you're not an arahant, then you can have little drops of these hindrances come in. But the mind should always not, it doesn't just sit there. It doesn't sit there resting the, you know, it just evaporates that fast. So you see quick and, you know, confidently dismiss it. You may not be confident in this method, but all you can do is try it. Try it for a month. Dismissal, prevention, dismissal, prevention. Just see what happens. You will see that you have power over the mind. You're not that conditioned. You aren't that conditioned. You're not controlled by your past or previous habit structures. They're there, but they're just conditional. They're not. They don't determine you. They're not your fate. They're only conditions which have a certain habit structure to them. But try doing this, and the habit structure weakens. And a new habit structure grows up, that habit of dismissal and prevention. So this is when you know, you do your breath meditation or your goodwill meditation, so forth. You know, just be, just enjoy it. It's creative, it's joyful, and remember that every time you drift, when you catch yourself, it's a moment of success. Another moment of success. Another moment. There are no failures. There's just moments of success in this. It's just a lovely, it's the ultimate game. It's much better than chess. Much better. It leads to all, chess just leads to, you either win or you lose. And then there's another game. But this is a accumulation more and more and more to something far beyond a game. To the sort of the core of the best of human possibilities. So, I will just, those are just suggestions, hopefully intimations or setting the mood for the day. Very positive, very joyful. That is what it's about. It's not just that everything's impermanent. That's not the primary truth of Buddhism. The primary truth of Buddhism is there's suffering. And there's an end to it. That's the primary truth. Everything else serves that end. We want you to be happy. There are all four or five levels of happiness. We want you to just stay with those four or five. You can juggle those four or five. We want you to not be unhappy. But the happiness, that quality of happiness, it's always changing and so forth. But it's not comparable or equivalent to the other states, the emotional states, negative emotional states. We're attempting to eradicate those altogether forever. And to remain within a range of, there's a variety of positive, beautiful emotional states. There's loving kindness, there's compassion, there's equanimity, there's sympathetic joy. There's creativity, there's generosity, there's patience, there's all kinds of beautiful emotional, mental states. It's a smorgasbord of possible, but don't go outside of that. Don't eat any more gravel or anything like that. You could break your teeth on those. Okay, so that's it for this morning. And I think what we'll do is maybe just stand up and stretch the legs for 5 minutes. We'll do a little sitting, and then there'll be a walking after that.